Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Ah, gee, what an uneventful week news-wise, huh? Well, good morning, everybody. What a way to start a show, huh? Hopefully you are well. Kind of a wet day. We're going to have some high wind a little bit later in the day today. I'm Bob Salter. On our program today, we have a lot to get to over the next couple of hours, and I'm very pleased to say that we have a couple of guests who are joining us in studio. In hour one of our program, we're going to be covering a variety of topics with the guests who are in studio with us. A gentleman who has spoken with us previously on this program is here again. He's braved the idea of coming back to WFAN on Sunday morning. He's also brought a law partner of his along. Brian Wagner is a criminal defense attorney and partner of Mowk, M-O-W-K, Law, which is based here in the city. Brian also is a former senior prosecutor for the district attorney's office in Brooklyn. He has talked with us before on our program. There's a couple of different areas where we're going to be going in the course of our discussion. His firm's website, by the way, is Mowk, M-O-W-K, Law. That's all as one word, .com. And first of all, it's nice to have you join us again on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. And your law partner is Dan O'Hara. Dan is an experienced trial attorney, problem solver, and he is joining us on our program as well to share some thoughts in some of these areas where we are going to go in the course of our discussion. Dan, welcome to the fan.
Oh, thank you very much, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to have you join us as well. I want to begin, we're going to be getting into some of the things that have been real hot in the news in recent days, including, of course, the whole situation with Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots. We'll get into talking about this whole situation involving Jussie Smollett. And yes, even getting into talking about Robert Kelly, R. Kelly, because there have been some very big cases in the news. But I wanted to start our discussion talking about something that is happening in New York. There's a crackdown that is taking place on impaired driving. And, you know, I guess in beginning this discussion, first of all, what exactly is this crackdown? What's this going to involve, right?
So the crackdown on impaired driving is really, in Manhattan in particular, and really across New York City and New York State, drunk drivers kill people. And because of that, because it's but by the grace of God, it could be me, they realize that this is a very serious crime that they're going to start taking even more seriously. And Joe Citizen, who otherwise doesn't commit any crimes, really can be arrested and will be arrested for these sort of things. And they're enforcing stricter penalties than they would have otherwise before a couple years ago. And for that reason, it's always important how you first interact with the cops, because what they say will really control how the prosecution goes forward.
And in many cases, people are involved, I would assume, in representing themselves, let's say, not in the best fashion in those initial interactions.
No one likes being pulled over by a police officer.
Especially if you've had too much.
It is incredible. And especially in New York City, the police officers have body-worn cameras. They see exactly how you react. And so it's harder to now go into court and say, he didn't say that or she didn't say that. That's not how the client reacted, when it's right there on body cam, not once but twice, because officers work with partners. So it's becoming more and more difficult. And for that reason, you have to tell your clients to really react appropriately.
Now, you bring up an interesting point because, you know, with the body cameras on law enforcement officers, Should we, as citizens, always assume that those cameras are on?
Yes.
Even, and you know, in some cases, they're not always on.
So they have a procedure and a set protocol for when they actually have to turn them on. But essentially, it's every time they're dealing with a civilian in a situation that could escalate. And so that's becoming more and more situations. And the way these body cams really came to be in the New York City Police Department anyways is they realized that whenever they were going into bad neighborhoods and there was an escalation, immediately civilians were taking out their cell phones. But it wasn't capturing the entire incident. It was just capturing when things already got heated. And so now the body cam's purpose is really to capture the entire incident so it can show how it actually got to the point of no return.
Mm. So what's your advice for somebody when they're stopped in a situation where they're being suspected of driving under the influence?
So first, take a real honest accounting of whether or not you are intoxicated. If you are, no matter what, you should always be polite. Second, if you are extremely intoxicated, yes, morally reprehensible. We're going to put that aside. I'm just talking about the defense aspect. The second thing is, if you are incredibly intoxicated, don't blow into that breathalyzer. You don't have to. Your license will be suspended. But if you're going to blow 3 or 4 times the legal limit, it's better to leave that unknown. Those are the two most important things. Be polite, be honest with yourself, and then make the best determination. And then finally, call an attorney as soon as you have the opportunity to.
Okay. You raised 2 points that I want to follow on. One is the breathalyzer. Okay. What standards are those held to? What kind of regulations are involved? You know, are they calibrated on a regular basis? I mean, is that the sort of thing that somebody who is charged in a case and their attorney or attorneys have access to that information?
So in terms of the calibration, there's 2 different types of breathalyzers that the NYPD and generally New York State Police use. First, there is a portable breath test. That's called a PBT. That's when you're on the scene and the officer says, blow into this.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, those are not calibrated. Generally speaking, those are not operated by people that actually know how to use them. And for those reasons, they're usually not admissible at trial. The only thing they do is give an officer probable cause to arrest. But in order for those to be even effective, the officer has to watch you for 20 minutes. Make sure you don't vomit, make sure you don't swallow, spit, eat anything, drink anything. All those things affect the efficacy of a breath test. The next one, in terms of the precinct, those are calibrated regularly. Those are operated by people that are trained on just those machines. And so those very much are calibrated and are admissible. But again, they need to be operated correctly. And those are generally videotaped as well.
Now, you give this advice about, you know, not doing this if you feel that, you know, you are in a situation where you are inebriated. What are the repercussions for somebody who actually does?
So driving in New York State is not a fundamental right. It's a privilege. And one of those conditions of that privilege is that you have to blow into a machine. If you do not blow into a machine, and you are told if you do not blow into this machine, you will lose your license, and you understand that, and your denial or refusal is unequivocal, meaning persistent and over more than one time, so 2 times, then your license will be suspended pending a DMV refusal hearing within 10 days. That's not a high bar. And your license will be suspended, but given the option of blowing 4 times the legal limit or having your license suspended, I think we'd all choose having our license suspended for that short period of time if proven our case will be that much easier.
Suspended for how long?
Suspended for 6 months. And I should tell you, if you are arrested, your license is going to be suspended pending the entire prosecution anyways. Now, there are things called conditional license that allow you to drive during that, but those are very limited in where and when you are allowed to drive.
So in other words, it's things like being able to go back and forth to work in some cases, things like that.
Exactly.
Would be part of the conditional license. Okay. And, you know, I should mention, too, that over the course of this program, because we're going to be getting into a whole lot of different areas, folks listening want to join us, weigh in on some of the things we're talking about, feel free. Our number here at The Fan, 877-337-6666. Then we get into the whole issue of people in traffic stops very often get verbose. What advice do you have there?
In terms of being argumentative?
And also just the information that they willingly provide in many cases.
So here's the thing. We've all been to a party. We've all seen an intoxicated person before.
Mm-hmm.
We know how he or she acts. Again, it goes back to having an honest assessment of yourself. If you are intoxicated, you need to realize it, and you need to just be quiet. You need to stop talking as much, and you need to just answer the questions that the police officer is asking you, nothing more. And try not to be verbose, because you're only digging your own grave, and you're making it harder on yourself in the future. So that right to remain silent, it's an incredibly important right that not enough people really avail themselves of.
And what about the whole idea of legal representation? Why is that so important?
So what an attorney's job is really just arguing where the prosecution is going to have trouble proving their case. And because they're going to have trouble proving their case, why a better result is appropriate. The more you talk, generally speaking, the bigger grave you are digging for yourself, and it makes the job of the attorney that much harder. Now, there are some things that you're going to say that are good, but generally speaking, what they're going to see is slurred speech. They're going to see argumentative. They're going to spend more time with you and notice the odor of alcohol on you. So less is more. In this case, less is definitely more.
And keep in mind that whole admonition that anything you say can and will be used against you.
It absolutely will be.
Hmm. Okay, that's that issue. The story came out last week about the owner of the Patriots, Robert Kraft, basically facing charges of soliciting a prostitute in Florida. This is part of a larger sting operation. How do things like that work?
So the way those things typically operate is they get inside information, whether it's through someone that was arrested or neighborhood complaints, that they think this sort of behavior is going on inside of this establishment. They will send undercover officers in and or informants, which are civilians that will be able to report back to the police.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, we talked about cameras. They also will have body cameras. In this case, they did. They had pin cameras, which are small little cameras the size of a lapel pin. And those are fact-finding missions. Once they realize how the operation goes, then they will really start an intense investigation of sending more undercovers in and looking at their financials and trying to understand the corporation in its entirety.
So in a case like this, this is part of, as I said, a much bigger investigation, because there's a whole lot of people who were named in this. What's the real upshot from this?
So the real upshot is, I don't think anyone is concerned about Mr. Kraft being a career criminal or becoming a recluse to society. What the real concern is the people that are operating the business, and how do you make it so that those people are disincentivized and stop trafficking human beings to do this sort of behavior? And that's where this is all going, is how do we get to them? And that's the upshot.
Well, this is, you know, we were talking about this before we started this discussion. This whole idea of human trafficking, and this is something we talked about a couple weeks ago on this show, this is a huge problem in this country. And this is, I guess, one of the ways that law enforcement can address this?
Yeah. What you need to make sure is that the people that would be inclined to traffic human beings, which is criminal and should be punished, are disincentivized, and make sure that it's just not worth the potential jail time that I could get.
Ryan Wagner and his law partner Dan O'Hara both in studio with us, talking with us on our program. We've got more to get to in the course of our discussion. Dan, you can speak up in this too. Don't be shy. Broaching 6:20, that's our time to take a look around the sporting world. You want to join us by phone, 877-337-6666 is our number. And at 6:20, I get the distinct pleasure of being able to turn to my left and see someone who I'm very familiar with, Jacob Wilkins, as our look around the sporting world. And good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. We're on our program this Sunday morning, hour one. We have guests in studio. They are joining us from Mauk Law, M-O-W-K Law, which is based here in the city, on the web at mauklaw, that's all is one word, .com. Brian Wagner and his law partner Dan O'Hara both in studio sharing some information with us. We've touched a little bit upon the New York crackdown on impaired driving. We talked a little bit about this situation involving the charges against Patriots owner Robert Kraft. He was one of 25 people who were said to be involved with this idea of alleged solicitation at the Orchids of Asia Day Spa in Jupiter, Florida, in South Florida. And I should mention the fact that Mr. Kraft has denied any wrongdoing. So that a case like this, ultimately, how long does something like that take to make its way through the court system if it goes that route?
In terms of his case, it'll be relatively quick. Now, whether or not his case goes the full route of a prosecution in terms of going to trial, that's highly unlikely. If it did, it would take about a year to a year and a half. What's more likely is that very early on in the case, he will agree to do some community service and or program for this sort of offense, and it will be resolved with a non-criminal disposition.
And when you say that he will agree, I mean, is that because of his status, his age, what the prosecution will come back at him with in terms of what he potentially could face?
I think the reality is his biggest concern is not going to jail or something of that nature, because that's incredibly unlikely. His biggest concern is what's going to be the implication in his NFL ownership of the New England Patriots. And once he figures that out, then the case itself will be resolved pretty easily with a program, because that's what his age, that's what his criminal history, that's what this offense really all calls for.
And then what happens to the people who were involved who were actually working at these facilities? Because I think there's something like 10 spas that were closed.
So in terms of the actual workers, what the prosecution will try to figure out is what workers were there by force, even if not physical force, by mental coercion or something of that nature. Hmm. Those workers will be really offered a way out by either help in getting back into society, but also testifying as to the conditions they were put through. And then the workers that were actually operating and running and in charge of the situation, their criminal cases will go through the system for a long time. And frankly, I think will end up being in either jail sentences and or severe prosecutions.
Now, to the public, is there a danger of that seeming unfair?
There's always that danger. And what a good public servant does is he or she explains what their job is to do what's quote-unquote the right thing to do for society. And generally speaking, and again, it's individual case by case, but generally speaking, someone that's just being forced to do something, we don't want to punish that person because it wasn't by his or her choice that they were there. On the other hand, someone that is forcing another person to do something illegal, they should be held accountable.
Okay, let's shift in discussion and touch upon another story that seemed to be everywhere this week. And this involves this actor from the show Empire, Jussie Smollett. He appeared in court on Thursday of this week after he surrendered to authorities in the early morning hours that day in Chicago. He's facing a felony count of disorderly conduct for filing a false police report. Now, on the surface, that sounds like, well, what does that really mean?
So when you speak to the authorities, whether it's the police or we see in the news a lot, the FBI, lying to them can be a crime by itself. In terms of filing a false police report, when you file a police report, you're saying essentially under oath that this crime happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
When you lie to the police and you take them away from other serious cases, you're diverting their resources. And for that, there's a criminal punishment. And that's what this felony is.
So in this case, the judge set his bond at $100,000. And he posted bond. He ends up being released from custody around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Chicago time, on Thursday. A lot of talk in the period of time surrounding this, a lot of talk in the period of time afterward. Should he go to jail if he winds up being convicted?
So, as a prosecutor for many years, and I'm a defense attorney, I will tell you it's been my experience that jail should be reserved for the worst of the worst. Jail is not a place where people go and get better, and it's not a place we should send people who are marginal, meaning marginal, they might be terrible or they might be okay. Because once you send them to jail, it's over. They're not going to come out better people, generally speaking, and that's my belief. It's my own personal belief. Other people can disagree. So for a guy like Jussie Smollett, what I think is appropriate is have him do tons of hours of community service. Have him make society better. But to send him to jail is just a quick and easy punishment that really doesn't serve anyone. The only thing it does is let people feel good on the outside for a couple of days, because after that, they're going to forget. He's still going to be in jail, not becoming a better person. And society collectively is not going to get any better.
But this case and the allegations against him raise a lot of basically very troubling questions in our society. So this involves a lot more from a societal standpoint than just the charge that he is specifically facing. Do we, society, learn from this?
So it's funny. You really hit the nail on the head in terms of things that I always talk about when I'm doing my criminal defense work, is the prosecutor's job is to do three things. What is right for society in general, which is, in this case, Cook County. What is right for the defendant given his or her criminal history and their act. And third, what's right for the victim. In this case, although it's not a victimless crime, there is no real complaining witness, individual. So it's society and the defendant. And does society learn by putting him in jail? I don't think so. I don't think there's going to be any larger aha moment similar to a Me Too moment. And so because of that, I don't see the benefit in trying to use him to make an example of. And also just morally, that's the thing that I would be going into with the prosecutor. You really want to use this individual to send a larger message? How is that fair to this individual? Doesn't that violate your obligation to do, quote unquote, the right thing, Mr. or Ms. Prosecutor?
Now, you saw, as did many of the folks who were listening to us or heard about or read about, the reaction from the Chicago superintendent of police, who was very miffed, I'll use that word, about exactly what had taken place on the part of Mr. Smollett and what that meant for the city of Chicago and, from his standpoint, what that meant in terms of the use, or some would say abuse, of the resources of the Chicago City Police Department, because there was a huge investigation that went for this. And some would say, well, wait a minute. If the police were involved in this kind of and this level of investigation, they couldn't be using their resources to address all the other crime that was going on. When we see that kind of a reaction, is that something to be expected from somebody who is a professional in law enforcement?
I think what you saw from the superintendent of the police was his being indignant by this sort of crime, and he should be indignant, and that has been my experience with public servants. They take their job seriously, and they want to do the right thing. And so when I saw him speaking, obviously I was impressed with what he was saying, but it rang true, and I think it was genuine. Having said that, in terms of the resources, NYPD, there's about 35,000 members of the service, police officers, detectives, sergeants, lieutenants, etc. So the idea that 15 of them or 20 of them or 30 of them are investigating this case and that's a huge diversion of resources, simply not true. Granted, those people that are investigating could have and should have been doing something else, but it's not as if the Chicago Police Department came to a screeching halt to investigate the Jussie Smollett case. The officer that's working a homicide is not leaving that homicide investigation to work the Jussie Smollett case. So, yes, it is a diversion of resources, but in reality, not as huge of a diversion as certainly we think it may be.
And in terms of the attention that this case has gotten in news media outlets, is that justified?
Yes. It's a newsworthy event, and we should draw attention to this sort of thing where someone fabricates a heinous crime. And I think by dragging attention to this, what people will realize is if you lie, you will get caught. And it is not hard to catch you in a lie because oftentimes the way a lie breaks down in terms of reporting it to the police is your story doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And a seasoned investigator, their antenna goes up. They just say something just doesn't make sense here. And when they dig a little deeper and dig a little deeper, the story unfolds pretty rapidly, which is what we saw in the Smollett case. They spoke to the brothers that were arrested. And once they spoke to them, they said, all things are off now because now we have video. Now we have a check. Now we have text messages. And Jussie Smollett's allegation quickly unraveled.
Okay. Now, let's speak honestly here. Who writes a check in a situation like that? I mean, it almost seems like a comedic act. I mean, is that believable?
Sadly, it is believable. In terms of who writes a check, he will claim, and I think he already has, that it was for personal training reasons. That is a foolish, dumb argument. What I would suggest if I was Mr. Smollett's attorney is stay quiet, mm-hmm. and stay quiet until you are ready to admit guilt, because everything you say is making you less and less sympathetic, and society is taking notice. Please stop putting out statements. That's what I would be telling him as his criminal defense attorney.
Okay. We're talking with Brian Wagner. His law partner is Dan O'Hara. They are both in studio from Mowklaw, Law, M-O-W-K-L-A-W, their web.com, their website. And I'll tell you what we'll do. I said we'd have the phone lines open during our program, 877-337-6666. Let's go to Patrick in Connecticut before our update. Patrick, good morning. Welcome to The Fan.
Good morning, guys. How are we doing?
Okay. Yourself?
Listen, this is such a bitter and terrible subject. Our country is being ripped apart at the seams by people baiting race. I think it's disgusting. And I honestly believe that if Mr. Smollett had been smart enough to face the camera the right way and this thing was on film with the attack, I think we would have been in a situation where we would have had a Rodney King riot situation across our country. And we can't have that. And he needs to go to jail. Now, you can put them in a white-collar crime where people steal money from people, that kind of facility. But he needs to go to jail so this doesn't ever happen again. Race relations in this country are too important. And what would have ensued if he had done this the way he thought he'd done it would have been terrible for our country. He has to go to jail.
Patrick, thank you for your call this morning. Travel safely. Care to address what Patrick said?
I think Patrick's point is a well-founded point, and reasonable minds can differ. It's just been my experience in criminal law that people that are questionable in terms of their act, of whether or not they should or should not, I tend to err on the side of not sending them to jail because the end result of sending someone to jail is they do not come out better, and society, therefore, is not better, which is why we have rehabilitation.
And so to that point, you know, I think our caller, places an emphasis more on the deterrent effect of punishment from that perspective and not from the focus on the individual. Do you have anything to say on that?
Yeah, I think that's, again, another well-founded point.
Okay. We can take a pause in our discussion. The voices of Dan O'Hara, Brian Wagner from Mauck Law, they're in studio with us this Sunday morning. It's Sunday morning on The Fan. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. We have a potpourri of topics that we have been talking about with our guests who are in studio. Brian Wagner, his law partner Dan O'Hara. They are both here representing MOWK Law. That's the website is MOWKLAW. That's all is one word, .com. And, you know, there's so many different areas where we can go in discussion, and this has been a week where it just seems like it's one case after another that is popping up. Speaking of Chicago and the Windy City, this case, or seemingly ongoing case, involving the singer R. Kelly. Now he is facing 10 counts of felony criminal sexual abuse. He has been through the criminal justice system previously. Let's talk about this latest case from the standpoint of, first of all, what this is that he's really facing, first of all. What does that mean in layman's terms?
In terms of potential jail or in terms of the crime?
Both.
In terms of the potential sentence, he's facing life in prison the rest of his life. He's, I think, mid-40s, and if convicted of all of these counts, the rest of his life is going to be spent in jail. In terms of what he's being charged with, essentially he's being charged with having sex with underage women on video. It's not an act that any of us can kind of just turn a blind eye to, unlike what we were just talking with Jussie Smollett, where we said jail is probably not appropriate or possibly not appropriate. Here, I think we would all agree that if the allegations are true, then jail is appropriate for him and serious jail time is appropriate, especially given what's the allegation of recidivist and repeat behavior.
Now, these 10 counts involve, as I understand, 4 actual alleged victims. And 3 of the 4 victims were they were teenagers when these crimes occurred. So how does that impact, I guess, the way that the case like this proceeds?
So the way I would differentiate this between the Smollett case is we were talking about resources of the Chicago Police Department and how the department itself is not actually affected. That's not the case with a 14-year-old girl, a 15 or 16-year-old girl. Those individuals are going to be carrying this disgusting behavior that occurred to them and the attack, even if they think it was consensual individually, it wasn't. By the very nature of their age and their susceptibility, they can't consent. And so forever, they're going to have personality issues and disorders that they might not even realize really affect them throughout their life. And that's why his punishment should be what it is.
And in a case like this one, as I mentioned in introducing this, he's been through this system before. How does that, or does it, or even should it, impact the proceedings?
Well, from a purely legal standpoint, in terms of his case that went to trial, they probably won't be able to mention that at all. And his acquittal, unless the defense attorneys bring that up as a red herring for a jury, it really won't enter into the fray. But mentally, it'll affect Mr. Kelly, I think. And the way it'll affect R. Kelly is that I find if a client has been acquitted, they think they're invincible. And you could see from Mr. Kelly's actions, his more and more brazen behavior, that he really does think that. Now, granted, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. This is just myself just analyzing it. And that's what I find from him, that he really believes he's above the law. And he's going to learn a pretty hard lesson, I think. And it's going to be learned maybe not next year, but 5-10 years from now when he's incarcerated for these heinous crimes.
And in a case like this, is this sending a bigger message to society if he is convicted of these charges?
I hope not. And the reason I say I hope not is for the same reason I talked about with Jussie Smollett. We shouldn't be using individuals to send larger messages to society. That's not fair to the defendant, and that perverts the criminal justice system. So I think by the mere fact that he's a celebrity, it will, but that should not be anyone's goal in any sentencing memorandum that's eventually provided.
Assuming this case goes to trial, is that going to be really difficult to find an actual jury?
It is. I've done enough sexual assault type of trials where the sensitive nature turns people off, and you don't want ultimately you want a jury that can be fair and impartial. And when you start introducing these sort of allegations, it's hard to find people that do not right off the bat say, I want to convict. Now, I know R. Kelly has a lot of goodwill in Chicago and people like him. Still, I think generally speaking, a jury in Chicago is not going to be R. Kelly fans in terms of this sort of behavior. And for him, it's really just going to be able to find a jury that can be fair and impartial.
Well, is it necessary in a case to do that, to change the venue, move the location?
You can, but then you'd have to argue that another venue would be more likely to be fair and impartial. You can't just change venues because we don't like this venue. It has to be this venue is not appropriate because they've already decided, and venue B, which is our next option, would actually be more fair and impartial. So I don't see that as likely to occur, but it's certainly an aspect that I would discuss with my client, and if my client thought it was worth a shot, we'd try it.
And I've got to ask you a question. In a case like this where you have somebody who has achieved a certain level of fame as an entertainer, in the case of R. Kelly, does that in the real world impact how he is perceived in the courtroom?
Absolutely. One, a judge, knowing that it's a media case, will handle it differently. He or she will handle it knowing that this will go through an appeal process. They always handle it fairly, and they always take it into serious consideration. But the fact that national media is paying attention always makes the judge and the attorneys step up their game and be a little more vigilant. Otherwise, I don't think it'll operate any differently than anything else, except for they realize it'll be under a microscope.
And in a case of something like this, is there, does it make it more difficult to try a case if the case winds up being televised?
Yes, 100%. And if I am the defense attorney, there is no chance I am letting any TV cameras into that room. And also, given that it's a 14, 15, and 16-year-old rape allegations and other things of the nature, I doubt a judge would permit those minors to be filmed, even if they're not minors at this point. So I don't think there's any real possibility of this being broadcast. I do think it will garner a lot of national attention, mm-hmm. but not necessarily video attention.
And what about the idea of him taking the stand if this goes to trial?
That is something that you never decide until the prosecution has finished their case. You prepare for it the entire time, and you always act as if your client is going to take the stand. But until you've actually seen the evidence, you're never going to do that. And in terms of him, I imagine he has enough skeletons in the closet and prior bad acts that you'd be very nervous about putting him up there. My general consensus or my general strategy is I put clients up there that are actually innocent and that have great explanations or are actually guilty and have nothing to lose. And this is our Hail Mary pass, to use the sports analogy since we're on WFAN. So he might fall into the latter. He might fall into the Hail Mary pass, but you're not going to know that until the prosecution finishes their case.
Mm. We're talking on our program on The Fan, Sports Radio 66, Sports Radio 101.9 WFAN, with Brian Wagner and Dan O'Hara. They are both with us from MOWK Law, which is based here in the city, MOWKLAW. That's all, it's one word, the website for their firm. What we'll do here is, before we shift in our discussion into one other area of a case that has also been in the news in this area, let's see if we can work in a call here via the phone, 877-337-6666. Our number here at The Fan, Ed in East Meadow, has been on hold for a long time. Ed, thanks for holding on. Welcome to The Fan.
Good morning, Bob. I enjoy listening to you each Sunday morning.
Thank you, Bob.
I'm a clinical social worker, 45 years, mm-hmm. and I do a lot of workshops for young people and so on. I think that whether it be Robert Kraft or Kelly or Jesse Smollett or anyone else, that there, if you do the crime, then you be prepared to pay the price. Unfortunately, and I think the two lawyers would agree with me, and I think about O.J. Simpson, which was televised. We live in a society where if you are rich and you have money, you have access to the best lawyers in the country. If you're poor, you know, no matter what your ethnic group, you might get a legal aid lawyer, or you can't afford the best defense lawyers in the country. And I think that that's why society continues, because the rich have a chance of plea bargaining, they have a chance of getting off, and they have the chance of not going to jail. And I think that, these people, again, just because they have money and just because they're famous, they did a crime, and they should be treated the same way as someone else who doesn't have access to the best lawyers in the country.
And I agree with Ed completely. They should be treated like anyone else. And what I would say is that's really what I'm advocating for, because if this were not a media case, they would be treated – Robert Kraft, for example, would be offered a program. He would be offered some sort of way to prove that he's sorry and that this is a one-off.
Yes.
In terms of R. Kelly, again, I agree. He should be treated like anyone else. He should – be given a right to a fair and impartial jury. And if the jury comes back and finds they prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, he should go to jail for the rest of his life.
Yes.
So I think you and I agree, Ed.
No, I think we do. I think that, and I'm glad to hear that, because you both sound like excellent lawyers and so on. I just wanted to, say this. A friend of mine recently wrote a book called The Nail of Integrity. And I think that the problem now in our country is people don't respect one another and the sense of integrity. And I think it's how we conduct ourselves each day. And I'm glad to see you doing the show this morning, Bob.
Thank you very much, Ed. Thank you for your kind words as well. Let's do one more call on the phone. Dan in Bethel, Connecticut. Dan, good morning. Welcome to The Fan.
Yeah, good morning. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
That's good. I just have to totally disagree with the gentleman you have on the show today in regard to his position on Smollett. The tale that he concocted and the extent that he, went through this whole process with the political climate and all of that. And if I know that if I were to come up with something of that magnitude, I certainly would expect that I would be thrown in jail for an extensive amount of time, as well as I totally believe that he should be. And I think it's really appalling for somebody to take the position that they don't think that this guy should go to jail. I really think it's really ridiculous.
Okay, point noted. Thank you for your call this morning, Dan.
Thank you very much. All right. Have a great day.
Okay, you tune up. You know, people feel very passionately one way or the other, and a whole lot of people with on either side in this case. You know, there's so many different areas to cover. Just very quickly here, because we got less than a minute before we have to wrap up. Just your reaction to the verdict in the El Chapo case, because that was 3 months of testimony, more than a week of deliberations. He's found guilty. Basically, he's facing a guaranteed life in prison.
My reaction? No-brainer. I would not want to be on that jury because it would scare me personally, but it's a no-brainer. The government brought a case that was ironclad, and the only issue now is that one of the jurors reportedly stated that they didn't listen to the judge's instructions to not read media accounts, and so we very well might have a retrial of that case.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. I want to thank you both for joining us, Brian Wagner, Dan O'Hara from MOWK Law, MOWKLAW, their website.com. Thank you both for joining us on our program.
Thank you so much for having us.
A lot of information we've covered. We got more to get to. We'll be talking about the Newark Museum in hour two of our program this Sunday morning. It is Rick Wolf with the Sports Edge program that follows our 8 o'clock update on The Fan this and every Sunday morning. Ed Randall is by talking baseball after our 9 o'clock update. And good morning, everybody. I'm Bob Salter. We move into hour two of our program. And in this hour of our show, we get to feature a discussion about an organization that we've never talked about on this program. And I've been doing this show for a long time, 25th year of doing this program on WFAN, and we've never in all the years talked about the Newark Museum. Now, some of you may be familiar with the Newark Museum. You're going to learn an awful lot about the organization in the course of our discussion. With us for the entire hour of our program is Deborah Kassendorf. Deborah is Deputy Director of Institutional Advancement, and she is responsible for management of the museum's fundraising and marketing departments, and she's joining us on our program. A number of other guests are going to join us as well. First of all, Deborah, it's nice to have you join us.
Thank you, Bob. Good morning.
And good morning to you as well. You know, part of the reason for our discussion today is to shine some light on the museum, and especially to shine some light on the museum's commitment to the idea of diversity. A little bit of background on the museum. How do you describe it for people who have never been, don't know the history of it?
There is a lot to describe. We're over 100 years old, so we were founded in 1909, and really since the founding, we have had a reputation as a progressive museum, and one of the reasons that we have enjoyed that reputation is the fact that from the very beginning, we were an approachable museum. So we are a museum for the community. We want everyone to feel welcome. This is not an intimidating place, and people tell us that. We are very committed to education. We serve over 40,000 school children each year and over 100,000 visitors. So for all of your listeners that haven't heard of it, we want you to come and experience it. We are the 12th largest collection in the country, and our primary collections are American, African, Asian. We have a Tibetan altar that was consecrated by the 14th Dalai Lama. We also have a vast earth sciences collection, and one of my favorites, our Victorian home, the Ballantine House. which was designated a national landmark in 1985. Go ahead.
It's quite a treasure. I mean, you talk about, you know, all of the things associated with the museum, its rich history. In terms of awareness about the arts and, you know, this whole idea of inclusion, how do you best try to get that message across to the public?
The best way I think that we demonstrate that is when folks come and visit us and see the programs and the exhibitions. Since the 1920s, we have been collecting African art. So this isn't something that we just started doing the last few years, but have been committed to showcasing our global collection in a way that, again, is approachable. So I think the best way that we demonstrate it is the exhibitions that we choose. And in a few minutes, we're going to have our American Art Collect curator talk about our upcoming show called Seeing America, which takes a very broad view of what American art is. But the other way that we are really including, we hope, all communities, again, is with our programming. A couple of highlights. Just this week, late Thursdays, we had over 600 people come for a celebration of Nina Simone. Every second Sunday, we have programming with live performances, artist panels, hands-on activities for all ages. In the summer, we present Jazz in the Garden. And we also present every summer the Newark Museum Black Film Festival, which is the longest running festival of its kind in the country.
I mean, all these different things that are going on. And how do people keep up with these sort of things? Are they on your website or just what?
They are on our website, but the best way to keep up with what's going on is to be a member. So thank you for that opportunity to plug.
Of course.
The museum is free to all Newark residents, as is a membership. And the reason that I do plug the membership is because if you are a member, then you're hearing from us often in terms of all these different programs that are going on, which are weekly. So, but if you're not a member yet, going to our website, also our Facebook page is a good way to find out what's going on.
All right. Would you introduce Tricia?
Yes. Good morning, Tricia. Tricia Bloom is our curator of American art. She and I were at the museum yesterday with a great program that she might talk about because it's a wonderful example of how we tie in programming that is inclusive with our exhibitions. Tricia has been at the museum. Tricia, is it 5 years?
Well, I came to the museum in 2015, so it's a little over 4 years.
And Tricia, welcome to our program on The Fan. Good morning.
Thank you, Bob. Hi, Deborah.
Good morning, Tricia.
In your role, what does that encompass as the curator of American art at the museum?
So, as curator of American art, I am responsible for the collections, which span from the 18th century to the present. And also, in my role, I have been the custodian and sort of project manager for the Arts of the Americas, which we treat as part of American art. And we do that through the way that we have installed our permanent collections. When you come to the museum, if you haven't been there before, and you come to the American, when you first come to a show called Native Artists of North America, and that showcases our North American historical collection. Again, we don't put too much of it from the contemporary period and with the historical because we treat contemporary art, living artists sort of all the same and integrate them in different ways. But so you go through this kind of wonderful reinstallation of historical objects from Alaska to, you know, I think the nearest. We don't have as much from the immediate community, but we do have the Delaware tribe is represented, but then as far away as Alaska and Northern California and the Southwest and the Northwest Coast. So that was a big project, reinstalling that collection in 2016, and became part of an ongoing goal to make the permanent collections look as diverse as they are. So in other words, we have, in American art, we have 12,000 objects. It's a really very deep and rich collection that has naturally represents the breadth of American culture. So we have now, when you come to see the museum, we've really forged a sort of semi-permanent installation that will show you highlights of the Latin American collection, highlights of the African American collection, but then throughout this kind of chronological narrative, we have that kind of lovely blending. So we have, for instance, we had Native American artists in our modern and contemporary collection. So getting those works out of storage and finding a way that they fit within the canon has been my goal, so that people can see that it's not just one kind of American art that we have. It's really multifaceted and exciting.
You know, I mentioned the idea earlier to Deborah about this whole commitment to diversity, because you used that term earlier in your answer. Promoting that, what's the response like when people discover what you have?
I think the response has been so positive and so affirmative, and I'll give you an example of the simple thing of the idea that when people come to the museum, they see themselves represented there, and being able to follow through on that. I mean, we've always had great special exhibitions that try and like cover a broad, ambitious and very real view of American culture. But now, as soon as we sort of made a semi-permanent place for instance, the Harlem Renaissance that doesn't go away, then we can offer those tours and classes for school groups, which is a part of every American school kids curriculum. So building that into our offering has been really great. And just enriching, as I say, we always had a Native American installation, but it's so much more vibrant and accessible. We've taken the objects out of cases and we've really treating them like artwork so that you can get up close and see the materials and see, you know, the uniqueness of the piece instead of having it in a less pleasing display. I think the term that comes up a lot when you're talking about any non-Western or indigenous artist as kind of an anthropological approach, which treats it more like a historical object than something more special than that, like an individually crafted thing that's worthy of careful inspection on its own. So we've gotten a lot of positive feedback. We've just seen more and more people responding. But there's a response, too, in terms of support for the museum. Like funders really appreciate that we are trying to make an effort to outreach more, and to use the collections to teach, this kind of message that art is for everybody. And that's a natural thing with American art.
Mm. We're talking on our program on The Fan, Sports Radio 66, Sports Radio 101.9, talking about the work of the Newark Museum. Deborah Kassendorf, who is Deputy Director for Institutional Advancement, is talking with us on our program, as is Tricia Lachlan Bloom, who is Curator of American Art at Newark Museum. When you're talking about the types of events, putting together these kind of exhibitions, what does that take time-wise? And
Tricia, do you want to answer that?
Sure. We have,
talk about Wendy Red Star.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long time. I mean, for programming, I think it really depends on the type of program that we're putting together. For something, I think the event that Deborah was talking about yesterday, we had a really wonderful panel that featured our current artist that we're showcasing, Wendy Red Star. The show's called Wendy Red Star, A Scratch on the Earth. And Wendy is a contemporary artist based in Portland, but she grew up on the Crow Reservation in Montana. And so her work deals a lot with Crow culture, but it's also really strongly interested in a feminist message and like a matriarchal culture and in a very contemporary, accessible way. So we wanted to do a kind of a large, impactful program to kick off that show, which opened yesterday. So working with our public programs manager really gets the credit for putting this program together, working actually directly with Wendy, who Wendy is really interested in, again, doing something that's very interdisciplinary and accessible. And she specifically said that she would like to work with a comedian because she uses wit and humor as a tool in her work. So we had a great panel of wonderful contemporary, all women, you know, it was very much about feminism, it was called Feminism, but a contemporary comedian, Cass Barbadoa, and another artist from Brooklyn, Chaya Babu, who's a writer. She's a Indian American, Southeast Asian Indian American writer living in Brooklyn. And so it's just really brought the themes in Wendy. We were able to bring in the themes in Wendy's work in a really natural way that reached out in a lot of different directions, involved a really lively audience participation, and was just lovely. So that, I would say in terms of building the audience and building the program, it is really a collective effort, and it's kind of amazing when it comes together perfectly, as I think it did yesterday.
Well, it sounds like very rewarding as well. Tricia, I want to thank you for joining us on our program and sharing some of the insights in your role as curator of American art at the Newark Museum. We certainly wish you the best with your efforts continued to.
Oh, thank you so much. My pleasure.
We're going to take a pause in our discussion, come back. We have more guests who are going to join us. Deborah is going to stick around as well this Sunday morning. It's Sunday morning on The Fan. Rick Wolf, Sports Edge, follows our 8 o'clock update. Ed Randall will be by. He'll be talking baseball after our 9 o'clock update on The Fan this Sunday morning. And good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. We are in a discussion on our program talking about the work of the Newark Museum and sharing some insight on the museum's efforts in the area of diversity and inclusion. A number of guests with us on our program, as I mentioned, with us for the entire hour today is Deborah Kassendorf, who is the Deputy Director of Institutional Advancement. And Deborah, you're going to introduce our next guest, if you would. Richard?
Yes, thank you. And good morning, Rick, and thank you for joining us. I have Rick...
Good morning.
I have Rick Thickpen from PSEG. And Rick, I think I need to ask you for your official title. I just know that you are key to supporting the museum.
So I have two titles I think that matter here. I am the, for Public Service Enterprise Group, our little local utility, I am the Senior Vice President for Corporate Citizenship. For the purposes we're talking today, I'm chairman of the board of the PSEG Foundation.
Thank you. Rick, we were just talking about our efforts and our programming with Seeing America, and Tricia Bloom, our American curator, was talking about the broad view that we take with American art, and she mentioned to the listeners the Native Artist of North America, which was one of PSEG's first pieces of support in our diversity and inclusion effort, although PSEG has been a longtime supporter of the museum.
Absolutely. And,
we were specifically talking about our new Seeing America exhibition and your part in that, as well as all of your efforts, which you might want to talk about. I could brag for you. But do you want to talk a little bit about some of the different programming? And, we're so grateful for the lift in the court recently as well.
So we are, at the PSEG Foundation, very proud to support the Newark Museum. It's been doing outstanding work for years and really lifting up the cultural life in Newark in a way that has exposed young people and others to things that they may not have otherwise seen. So first off, we're very proud of the Newark Museum and been very proud for years of the great work it does. We are also very proud of the Modern and Contemporary Seeing America Galleries series, which is really thoughtful in our mind in that it helps young people and really others see more of American history than they've frequently been taught in schools, and have people understand that there's so many different people who've contributed to American history, and that we're the product of something that a lot of us have contributed to. That kind of knowledge is good because it's true and accurate, number one, and it also helps younger people and all of us, you know, breed a sense of tolerance and respect for others, because we literally and actually are all in this together. And New Jersey, among almost any other state in the country, is truly a state of immigrants, truly a state that is booming with diversity. So I've heard that word used a lot today, but it's really not meant to be a politically correct term, but a term that describes the reality of who we are and how we got here. So anyway, we're very proud of it because we at Public Service recognize who New Jerseyans really are, and that there's a place for all of us at the table, and that it's always great to have art be, help people understand that so many different cultures and peoples have contributed to the America that we see today.
Thank you. It is true that we've talked about diversity a lot today, but I also mentioned earlier that the Newark Museum has been collecting globally since the 1920s, and I know that PSEG has a long time been a partner in those kind of efforts with the museum and other institutions. I mentioned a minute ago the ADA compliant lift in our Englehart Court, which was such a great initiative that we partnered together on. And when we have these large events like this Thursday, when we have 630 people in the museum, I saw the lift really being used to help folks actually be able to participate in a way that they hadn't before in a very community public space with our court. So thank you for that.
Yes, and you know, and that's also important in a part of the theme. Not only do you want people, young people especially, to think globally, but we want to also make our exhibits, make our facilities available to everybody. And some of us have limitations on our mobility, and the fact that the Newark Museum is willing to take the trouble to respect those limitations and make it possible for even a broader range of people to see the fabulous materials they have there is just once again something we're very proud of and very proud to help make it happen.
Rick, in terms of, and this is Bob Salter, good morning to you. Being involved in the arts, let's kind of expand on this a little bit from the standpoint of PSEG. Why is that important? What does that mean for the company?
So that's a very interesting question. Public service is, as I make the joke to my friends, the land of the engineers. There are people who spend their lives making the system work, and they do it with a remarkable commitment to excellence that's very impressive. But that's a long way away from the world of the art. Public service, and my title reflects it, is not just a big business in New Jersey. It is also a corporate citizen in New Jersey. And the cultural life of New Jersey is a very important part of what makes our state special. And it's a very important part of making our state home to so many different people. So the arts have so many more functions than just, you know, to look at. They help people respect and understand different cultures. They help people, you know, enjoy the aesthetics of nature and the things around them. They help people appreciate cultures they sometimes have experienced themselves and sometimes cultures they have not experienced. And frankly, culture helps bring people downtown. It helps bring people together. There are people who come to the Newark Museum who might not otherwise be inside the city of Newark because of the culture that they can find there. And that's good for Newark and that's good for New Jersey. The more we intermingle and live together, hopefully the easier it will be for us to live together as we go forward. So the arts plays an important role in that, and the arts even plays the important role in the land of the engineers, and we recognize that, and we're really proud to be a part of making such an outstanding cultural institution be, you know, made available to so many people in our great state.
You know, I said this the other day when I was talking with Deborah in preparation for our discussion. The museum really, and I guess this isn't overstating it, really in a way is kind of like a treasure in New Jersey's largest city, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It really, truly is a treasure. You can come and see pieces of the whole world. You can learn about history. They teach young people about science. They broaden minds. They open hearts. It really is an outstanding institution. And like I said before, it brings people into Newark who might not otherwise come. And it puts Newark on the map in a extra way, in that it does house one of the state's, if not the nation's, leading cultural institutions. And not only can you learn about Native American and Latin American art, you can learn about the art of, you know, that there's all different types of American peoples who've contributed to art. But you can also learn about Africa. You can learn about India. You can learn about Asia. And so it's really a place that for years has stood for excellence itself. Public Service is proud to stand for operational excellence, and we think of the Newark Museum in the same light, operational excellence, and really bringing outstanding cultural exhibits, you know, before the young people and before the residents of Newark. And we just hope they want to keep doing it. The longer they do it, the better it's going to be.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you for all the support.
Oh, absolutely. No, it really is proud for us. And really, you know, making Newark a better place helps make New Jersey a better place. And the Newark Museum does play an important role in doing that. And we truly are proud to be a supporter of the Newark Museum. And we're especially proud of this exhibit and that the Newark Museum recognizes, and today is a time to recognize it, that the challenge of inclusion, the challenge of respecting different cultures, the challenge of bringing us all together and respecting our differences is really greater today maybe than it's been in recent years. And we're very proud to play a part in helping everyone see a little bit of each other in America and that there's a place for all of us here, and it's not about who belongs and who doesn't belong.
Hmm. Totally agree.
And from the standpoint of the museum, Deborah, I mean, mm-hmm. that's kind of right up the museum's alley. I mean, it's something that a role the museum certainly wants to play in terms of promoting this whole idea of diversity, inclusion, and respect.
Absolutely. It does take a lot of work. As Rick said, it's an ongoing challenge to, I don't even know that you ever get it right, but I hope that by hearing from Tricia too, we were able to communicate the care and the thought that we put into it and that we will continue to, because we're learning every day as well by working with different artists and listening to our visitors.
And, you know, very often we hear from nonprofit organizations of the struggles that they face, the tough times they face in terms of finances, operations, wanting to do things that money provides an obstacle for them. Something like the support of PSEG Foundation obviously is very key to your operation.
It's critical. And PSEG, again, has been supporting the museum. I've just been there for 3 years, but I know that they have been supporting the museum for years and are always really open to new ideas. This particular grant to support Seeing America was very broad and generous and, again, went all the way from, well, first of all, let's talk about how the museum could be more accessible just as you enter the door for people with mobility issues. So let's start from the basics of helping everyone enjoy and participate it, and then let's go with PSEG all the way to what the content is from both programming. They also just recently sponsored our Latinx Festival and to the exhibition. So we could not do what we're doing without partners like PSEG.
And how do your employees get involved in that kind of support as well, Rick?
or our employees are involved in so many different ways. You mean it, well, in terms of helping the corporation connect with the communities that we serve.
Mm-hmm.
They are big on volunteerism. We have so many Little League coaches and PTA volunteers who work at public service. We can't tell you how proud we are of that. We do things as a corporation to inspire, a volunteerism and try to provide some financial support to those who are willing to volunteer in their communities. We try to make sure that we have executives sit on the boards of important nonprofits and important institutions in the state, including the North Museum. So the public service employees are a key part of us building a reputation as a friend to the people of New Jersey, to building a reputation as one of the institutions that is helping make New Jersey a better place. And in really helping in a thousand little ways and sometimes bigger ways solve individual challenges and individual problems in many of the over 300 communities that we serve as a public utility. And, you know, our people live in more communities than we serve. And so we feel proud to have our hands involved in so many different areas of New Jersey, from the local list of issues, you know, to things happening on your block in your neighborhood, to things happening in the state house as well. We try to be involved every step of the way in between. And the North Museum is really a piece of that bigger picture. It is perhaps the iconic example of an outstanding community institution that is really bringing things to make our state better. And so we have a member on the board. We provided financial support. And we have staff at the foundation who are constantly interacting with the people at the museum to see what's going on, to see how we can help them prepare for the future, to see how they can help bring young people in to get exposed to culture, to see how they can bring people from the community in to help everybody understand that, you know, just for example, that Native American and Latin American art is American art, and that we're all Americans, and that there's room for all different types of Americans. You know, little things like that to me are extremely important. And public service is truly playing, even if it's a small role, in making our state a better place by supporting institutions like the North Museum and having our employees out in the street, you know, helping people in their community do things better. And so we're very proud of that mission. We're very proud of that message we send. And we're very proud to be called public service because so many of our employees take that name home and actually live up to it.
I want to thank you very much for sharing some insights as well on the work of PSC&G. Rick Thigpen is the Senior Vice President, Corporate Citizenship for PSC&G. He's also the Chairman of the PSEG Foundation. Thank you. Certainly good luck continued with your efforts.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Rick.
Deborah, we're going to take a pause in our discussion. We'll come back. Another guest is going to join us here on The Fan.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, 3-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.